This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Sean Grace. He's the president of the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania. So, welcome, Sean. It's great to be talking with you. I visited there many years ago when I was a kid, and so I'm anxious to hear what you have to tell us about it.
Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, we just had a little bit of a nice storm last night, and just plugging away here up on the Kittatinny Ridge.
Okay. So, Sean, tell us about your background and how long you've been with Hawk Mountain.
I've been with Hawk Mountain now for 7 years. I've always been passionate about wildlife. And I started my career out actually running mountaineering shops. I've done that for a while, and then I went back to school and I did an advanced degree in environmental science studies and education, did my master's work. I have a master's plus 20. And then I changed the direction of my career to be more working directly in conservation. And I've now worked for a variety of organizations, including the Teton Science School. I ran a branch of that called Wildlife Expeditions for a while.
Jackson, Wyoming.
Yeah, in Jackson, Wyoming. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I worked for the New Jersey School of Conservation. I actually worked for New Jersey Audubon, which is the second largest of the state-run Audubons. I ran a sanctuary for them and developed educational programs before moving to Princeton University in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Then I ran four sanctuaries for National Audubon, including a wildlife rehabilitation unit where we focus primarily with raptors. And then an Eastern Forest program about how to improve your lands and habitats for bird and bird diversity. That was also a part of what we did along with, you know, regular environmental education. And then I moved on to Hawk Mountain. I've been here for 7 years now.
So tell us about Hawk Mountain. Who got it started? When? Why? And why is it unique?
Yeah, so Hawk Mountain was started in 1934, and Hawk Mountain is on the Kittatinny Ridge, which is 185 miles, and it runs from north and east to sort of south and west across the state, sort of in a little bit of a diagonal line, and it's part of the Appalachian Mountains, and as winds hit those mountains, coming from the north and west, it creates a wave, and raptors migrate on that wave, and it's very energy efficient. They don't have to do powered flight. A lot of it can be gliding and soaring, and there's, you know, readily available birds and small mammals in the forest that they can hunt and carrion that they can find along the way, and they use that as a migrational path. Hunters knew this, and they used to set up blinds, and sometimes they would tether birds to poles, and that would be attractive to raptors that would be migrating down. They'd swoop in for a closer look, and they would shoot them, you know, with shotguns. And so that was happening. That was documented by Richard Poe, who went on to found the Nature Conservancy. And he presented some of those pictures and put those in circulation in New York City. And a woman by the name of Rosalie Edge got a hold of those and started working actively to end the shooting. And so she leased the land in 1934 and then came back the next year, raised the money to purchase the land. And originally our sanctuary was like 1,400 acres, and now today it's at around 2,600 acres in land acquisition and expansion. And there was another key couple, Maurice Brune and Irma Brune, his wife. They were brought on right away to essentially protect the sanctuary, to keep hunters out. It was at that time just a dirt road going up and over the mountain. And so he was implemented and put on site. He posted the property. But the big thing about Maurice is he was extremely detail-oriented, and he started going up to North Lookout. That's where we do our official count. And he started making notes on the number of raptors that he would see on a daily basis. across 16 different species that we count to this day. And so the unique thing about Hawk Mountain, outside of like 1 or 2 years during World War II, you can go back over any of those years online and you can see what our count data is
that,
for that day, for what species it is. And those long-standing data sets we now know have incredible value because you know what the historical numbers were. Maybe with certain raptors, maybe those numbers went down, maybe they came back up, and then you need to do science around that and find out why that happened. So Hawk Mountain is founded based upon science, education, and then stewardship of our lands. So that includes managing our forests for invasive species and improving them. We do education across 20 different types of education that we offer, everything from little kid programs all the way up through adults, including our world-class trainee program. We started a trainee program in the mid-1980s, and that's now had 512 post-college graduates that have come through that program from 76 countries around the globe. And those people go back to those countries, and they either study specific species of raptors, they establish raptor counts or fundus. And so now there's this huge network that Hawk Mountain has helped to create. And then some of those folks go on, and they continue their studies through their graduate degree and through their PhD level. This year, Hawk Mountain helped sign off on 5 different PhD candidates that completed their doctoral research. There's so many different avenues and stories that I could talk about the work that we do, be it raptors like the Kestrel program that we do or broadwings that we do locally here, or the fact that we're the only organization that works on New World vultures, which are very important to our environment. Or I could talk about that we just released on the status of snowy owls, the circumpolar population of snowy owls around the globe, and that those numbers are significantly less than what they thought they were. The magnitude of like 10 times less than what they thought they were.
You told me that there are a number of count sites around the country. Are there any other sanctuaries that are similar to Hawk Mountain, or is it unique?
I think there are some other places that are now sanctuaries that look to protect their lands specifically for raptors. What's unique about Hawk Mountain is we were sort of a catalyst organization or an influencer. Like people talk about influencers on social media. Hawk Mountain in the mid-1970s held a meeting with folks that were interested in raptor counting, and there was 3 principal tenets of that meeting. One, they wanted to create folks that really knew raptors so to create better counters. 2, they wanted to establish more count sites, and 3, they wanted to ensure that they had a consistent raptor counting protocol.
Mm-hmm.
That's your scientific work, your scientific methodology on how you count raptors to make sure you're not double counting or missing birds, and to make sure that you have consistency. And they did that, and now there's more than 200 count sites here in North America. Excuse me. And you can go to an organization called hawkcount.org. And at hawkcount.org, they log all the count sites and the different species that they see on a daily basis and what their numbers are. So now that's one point or one data set that you can go and you can mine to look for trends in raptor populations. Mm-hmm. And are those trends on East Coast birds, West Coast birds? Is it ubiquitous across all of North America? And that's really important because you can look at trends. So, you know, like one important story I could share is many of us have heard of Rachel Carson. She sort of founded the environmental movement. She wrote her groundbreaking book, Silent Spring, which is really about the use of DDT and the fact that it wholesale, you know, kills many different kinds of insects in the forest, including all the Lepidoptera species, all the things that become caterpillars and moths. And a lot of that really drives bird migration. So you can imagine the birds show up. Most birds are insect obligate feeders to their young, and there's nothing to eat. So all these bird songs that you're hearing, that's all changed. But, of course, we know as that goes up the food chain, that only magnifies. And so birds like the bald eagle were particularly impacted with thinning of their eggshells due to biomagnification of DDT in their systems. But that was also true for birds like the osprey and the peregrine falcon, whose numbers were also, all of these large raptors, their numbers tanked. And we went back and did additional research on the accipiters and other birds of prey, and found that those numbers also declined significantly. What's interesting is now that we've put protections in place, this year we set, the last actually 2 years running, we've set records for the numbers of bald eagles that have been counted from our North Lookout. And this year I believe it was 639 bald eagles.
Wow.
So, that's a great success story. They've been taken off the endangered species list, as has the peregrine falcon. But then I could look at birds like the American kestrel, which has been on a 30-year 2% decline of the species on the east coast of North America per year, every year. If we went back 25 years ago, we'd have as many as like 120 nesting pairs of goshawks in Pennsylvania. Last year, we had one pair. So some species are doing very well, and some species are not doing so well. There's still lots of sharp-shinned hawks, but their numbers are down from historical highs and down significantly. And if I look at sister organizations like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, they talk about the loss of 3 billion birds over the last 30 years. And so you can imagine that's less thing for the accipiters that are bird hawks to hunt. And so those species, their numbers are now trailing down. So everything's connected. And I like to say that when we create healthy environments for raptors, apex predators, naturally, we're creating healthy environments for people. So it's something I think that we're all passionate about, but it's also being self-interested in some ways.
Is Hawk Mountain located in a remote location, or is there other development surrounding it?
I would say it's in a rural area. And, you know, Hawk Mountain also acts as a land trust in some ways. And when we can, we'll help to guide purchasing important properties and either, you know, trying to get those in conservation easements or trying to maintain the rural character of the area, which I think is in the best interest of, you know, for wildlife. But it's also nice to have areas that are that remain fairly pristine. And for us, as for many of these raptor count sites, they're typically areas that overlook massive expanses of area. And for us, some of that is rural farmland. But it would be nice in 50 years to go up to North Lookout and see that it's still largely rural in nature and that there hasn't been exponential development.
Is there much shooting of hawks that goes on today in the vicinity, in the same vicinity?
No, so we stopped it in 1934, but some of the hawk shooting continued at other sites north along the ridge. And our curator, Maurice Brune, put his assistant curator up to going up to some of these sites to see what was going on. And he told the folks that he was collecting dead hawks for to create specimens for museums and that kind of thing. And that way they weren't sort of on to him and what he was doing. But through that process, I think in that weekend, he picked up north of 600 dead raptors. So it was still quite a problem, but over time, Hawk Mountain, through education, educating the local community, eventually protections were put in place for raptors, except for goshawks and accipiters, which were still considered vermin. They were considered to be competitors with hunters. That was sort of the thing back in the day. And then eventually, in 1972, with the Endangered Species Act, it offered more protections across the board for migratory birds and for raptors, and that, of course, is very important. But if we look around the globe, some of our trainees founded a place called the Batumi Raptor Count Site in Batumi, Georgia, along the Black Sea. And I've been there. They count 1.4 million raptors, say, a year. But while you're there watching these magnificent, in this case, 32 different species of birds that migrate through, you're also hearing gunfire go off, and you're actually seeing raptors drop from the sky. And so people are still using them as, like, wild game meat. And if you go down to South America, there are certain countries where shooting is still a significant concern.
Are there any relationships that local or state governments have with Hawk Mountain?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there historically along the Kittatinny Ridge, there's been additional cow sites. And with the Pennsylvania Game Commission, they recently purchased Wagoner's Gap, which is another known hawk mount site.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking to expand education there. Normally, they do mostly, fish and game style things for hunters and fishermen. But they wanted to expand wildlife viewing as an option. And so they partnered with Hawk Mountain. And the counter that's up there is a fellow named Brandon Bogle, and he is one of our former trainees. And we also hired an educator to educate people about raptors and what's going on. And then if we look at, across our training network, in the Mesoamerican corridor, there's like 10 different mega count sites. There are count sites in Costa Rica, in Panama, in Colombia, in Bolivia. All these count sites are founded by former Hawk Mountain trainees. Hmm. And these are some of the sites that get the highest number of raptors per year anywhere on the globe. And we're, actively working to link up those sites via social media, ensure that there's consistent protocols. It becomes a whole different game when you're counting hundreds of thousands of raptors per day versus, 1,000 raptors per day. And so you have to make sure that you have consistent protocols that are being implemented and utilized. And that's also some of the periphery work that we do. But, Hawkman, essentially what we do is we do science, uh-huh. education, and then stewardship of our lands. And on the science front, we published more than 400 scientific papers about raptors all over the globe. And the way that we're able to produce so many scientific publications is we oftentimes will partner with sister universities. They have PhDs that are interested in answering certain questions about certain species. We'll team them up with one of our trainees, and then they'll embark on doing a graduate and a PhD on whatever that species is. Mm-hmm. And then Hawk Mountain weighs in, but they're helped to guide the person through their program and through their studies. And oftentimes we'll give them money for their various field materials that they need for their studies. It could be transmitters or any of the things in that realm. And they produce great scientific work. And then you have a university, you have Hawk Mountain, you have the person that's actually doing the majority of work. That's the PhD candidate. And it's a great way for us to publish. And that's part of the Hawk Mountain model.
Uh-huh.
And then I'd also say the Hawk Mountain model is also like connecting communities to conservation through education. And that's something I am passionate about. That's one of my monikers. I'm deeply connected to that. And I think all conservation starts with education. It's when you convince people why the species is worth saving, why the habitat is worth saving, and why they should be interested and why they should care.
Right.
And that's an important mission.
What's
and
the
I'm
length?
Passionate about it.
What's the length of the migratory path of some of the raptors?
It all depends on the species. The Broadwing hawk.
Yeah.
Well, some of those birds are nesting up in Ontario, and they'll go down to the Amazon basin. And some of them will go up onto the westward side of the Andes down in South America.
Uh-huh.
And then if we look at, like, the peregrine falcon, that's probably the longest distance raptor migrating. And that can go all the way from the Arctic all the way down to the very south of Patagonia.
Ah, wow.
Just in the winter.
That's enormous.
Raptors are migrating like 40% of the year, either to their breeding grounds or to their wintering grounds. And what's interesting about it is the fact that these raptors will go, and because we have transmitters on them, they're roosting in the same trees on their wintering grounds that they were last year.
Mm.
And when they come back, it isn't like raptors come back and like, oh, Tennessee seems like a good place to set up shop. We'll raise a family here. If they were raised in a section of woods,
uh-huh.
in Pennsylvania, they go back to that exact same acreage as long as the habitat hasn't changed.
Okay.
And they'll find a tree, build a nest, and that's where they breed. So they're connected. It's specific raptors and families of raptors are connected to individual properties. and where they migrate to and from. Now, 40% of the year they're migrating, and raptors are like twice as likely to die during migration as they are if they're on their home territory, a place that they know. They know where the food is. They know where the danger is.
Right.
They know good areas to roost. But it's all of those unknowns. And as you can imagine, if you were a raptor and you could live a lifespan of 100 years, and you could imagine that you're still in that migration corridor, can you imagine the change that you would have seen?
Yeah, right. Are there some...
And
are there,
so it's interesting that... go ahead.
Are there some raptors that are just local in the United States and they don't migrate further south, across the Mexican border or further south?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, birds like red tails, oftentimes they're just going to head to some of the southern states.
Uh-huh.
The American kestrel, oftentimes they'll go down to like northern Florida, and just to milder climates, just to avoid the snow and the snow cover,
uh-huh.
and then they come back. But some species, like I said, are very long distant migrants.
Uh-huh.
And some birds that we sort of take for granted, like folks will, you know, turkey vultures, they'll call them turkey buzzards, they'll take them for granted, and black vultures. But if you can imagine how they really help to keep, with the amount of roadkill alone that happens, forget dumps and garbage and all that kind of thing. Just think about all those carcasses if they were just left to be out and rot and contaminate water. And they really help to eliminate that. And so they do this incredible service, which in turn prevents a lot of disease and disease manifestation. And they're very important. We're, like, as far as I know, we're the only major raptor conservation organization that studies New World raptors. And if you look at sheer numbers of volume of raptors that migrate through Central America, through Panama, the highest counts are for turkey vultures, and that'd be followed by, like, broadwing hawks are oftentimes right up there, and then Swainson's hawks, they can be large numbers. And if you go down into South America, the most common raptor you would find is the black vulture.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, they're really important species, and those are some of the, those are some of the raptors we also study.
And
we've recently had people that have released information about saw-whet owls. We just put out a paper on the global status and distribution of the circumpolar snowy owl, which originally they thought those numbers were like around 300,000 to 500,000. Now they think it's more like 28,000 to 30,000.
Mm.
So that's a magnitude of at least 10 less than what they were originally thought to be.
Yeah.
Some species, like if we look at nocturnal raptors, like screech owls and great horned owls, those tend to be non-migratory. Some lesser-known owls that are more secretive, like saw-whets, those are heavily migratory.
Uh-huh.
Long-eared owls are migratory.
How far
snowy owls are migratory. Short-eared owls are migratory.
How far do those migratory owls go to the south?
It all depends. You know, I think a lot of times it tends to be heavily distribution, especially of young of the year. Adults will be more tethered to their breeding grounds because they want to maintain those areas as their own. And the data shows that in big flight years, it's predominantly young of the year from really successful years where they're able to put out lots of young. And they'll go, you know, from Canada all the way down into the southern states, like down into Tennessee and Virginia, and West Virginia.
So the Hawk Mountain is located along the Appalachian Flyway. Are there other flyways going west that are quite prominent?
Yeah, you know, where there's major mountain ranges, those tend to be good spots where you will find migration and migration corridors.
Why do they look for mountain ranges?
Well, mountain ranges, if you're getting strong winds that are hitting a geographical feature like a mountain range, especially one that runs north to south,
right,
it creates a wave of energy that's going up and over that mountain.
Right.
And raptors are sort of like three-dimensional sailors or three-dimensional surfers. And for all animals in nature, they're governed by the law of conservation of energy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would oftentimes ask people, like, how often do you think deer are running? Well, every time I see a deer, it's running. Well, that's because they saw you first, and they're running away.
Uh-huh.
But most of the time, wild animals are trying to expend as little energy as they can.
Uh-huh.
So the answer for deer is 98% of the time, they're walking. And with raptors, if they don't have to do powered flight, and they're able to cover long distances by utilizing those wings, they will. And then those forested areas along those mountain areas, which are oftentimes harder to develop, so less of them are developed, there's more open land. Those are also going to hold high numbers of small mammals and rodents in particular. And then the surrounding farmlands and flatter areas off of those mountain ranges tend to be really good areas for birds because you have a diversity of habitats, you have water, you have brushy areas to hide in, as well as forests to escape to. So,
in the Mississippi Valley, there's no flyway, is that right, for raptors? And going
well,
on
I'd
to the Rocky
have,
Mountains?
I'd have to look at specifics and specific species. I'm more dialed in on what's happening right here at Hawk Mountain. But I know there are, you know, again, you could go to hawkcount.org, and you can find all the raptor count sites that are in your neck of the woods.
Well, thanks very much. Our guest today has been Sean Grace. He's the president of Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana.
To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com to hear this and other interviews that we've done recently. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.